Exploring the history of cannabis culture. One artifact and interview at a time. This is Canthropology. Presented by the World of Cannabis Museum Project. With your host, World of Cannabis Executive Director, Bobby Black.
Greetings, fellow cannabis enthusiasts, and welcome to another edition of Canthropology, the podcast that explores the history of cannabis culture, one artifact and interview at a time. As always, I'm your host, Bobby Black. You know, it was 22 years ago this month that two gay cannabis activists were gunned down by the FBI and state police after a five-day siege on their farm in Vandalia, Michigan, that has often been referred to as the Waco of Weed. Tom Crossland and Raleigh Rome were the owners and operators of Rainbow Farm, a 35-acre property where they hosted annual pro-cannabis events such as Hemp Aid, the Roach Roast, and the World Hemp Expo Extravaganza that attracted famous performers and activists and became the state's hub of cannabis legalization efforts. That is, of course, until an ambitious local prosecutor made it his mission to destroy their lives. The tragic story of these drug war victims was recounted in articles in both High Times and Playboy magazines and in the 2000 book Burning Rainbow Farm, but sadly never got the national coverage it deserved, thanks to the media frenzy surrounding the terror attacks of 9/11, which took place just 1 week after their deaths. In this episode, we'll revisit the details of their tragic tale from the perspective of Rainbow Farm owner Tom Crossland's nephew, Boss Crossland Jr., who joins us today via phone from Vandalia, Michigan. Boss, thanks so much for agreeing to speak with us today and sharing your uncle's story.
Thank you for having me. I'm grateful.
Well, I'm grateful to have you here. I'd like to just start off by having you tell us a little about yourself and then also about your late Uncle Tom.
All right. Well, my family all moved up here from Tennessee and Kentucky. Grover Crossland was my grandfather. Grover Tom Crossland was my uncle. They started working in northern Indiana doing multiple different jobs. My uncle decided to go into real estate and started to flip houses and things like that. He was doing a great job at that. He got the opportunity to buy a little piece of property up in Cass County, Michigan. And he brought me up here one day saying how I'm thinking about buying this property. And I looked out here and all I seen was corn growing in all the fields. And I'm thinking, okay, I was about 12 years old at the time. I'm like, all right. And he ended up buying it. And a few years later, that's what turned into Rainbow Farms.
Yeah. Well, what kind of a man was he? How would you describe his political and or spiritual beliefs?
He wasn't go to church every Sunday type of person. Did he believe in God? Yeah, he believed in a God. He kept to himself. He was a very generous man, which a lot of people don't know, because he did so many things for our community, especially the community up here in Vandalia in Michigan. There was a day when Robert came home from school, which was Raleigh's son, and I guess he had to eat peanut butter and jelly sandwiches at lunch that day. My Uncle Tom was like, why? And Robert proceeded to tell him, well, I didn't have any lunch money on my tab at school. So my uncle went down to the school and paid lunch for every single kid in that school for that year.
Wow.
To make sure they didn't have to eat no peanut butter and jelly sandwiches and be singled out. Every kid got a plate lunch, and that's back in the 90s. That's back before people were, like nowadays you see people doing that type of stuff. But that's back in the 90s before anybody even thought of doing things like that.
Yeah, that's a beautiful gesture for sure. You know, in researching Rainbow Farm and your uncle online, I've seen that there were several instances of this kind of generosity that he would exhibit. But I also read that some people had accused him of being a bit of a hothead and that, you know, and that he'd had some run-ins in with the law earlier in his life. Can you talk a little about that at all?
Yeah, I mean, he was young. I mean, everybody is. Now, granted, you know, when he was younger, He did work at a car wash. And he put his hours in for that week. When he went to pick up his check, they said he was fired and wouldn't give him his check. So that's when he went home, grabbed his gun, went back down to the same car wash, took exactly what they owed him. And, of course, he went to jail for armed robbery then.
So there's
a lot to everything. I mean, a lot of people hear one side of stories, you know, and they'll see, oh, he was arrested for this or he done that. But there's always two sides to every story. It's you just got to, you know, people got to hear each side.
Right. And that's what's so valuable about having someone like you on the show to be able to tell that side, because not many people would know that side of it.
No. And a lot of people don't. And that's the thing that hurts me the most, because I've watched what my uncle tried to do here in Michigan, because I was about 16 when he had his first festival. I was out here for every event. I was out here before it even was Rainbow Farms. But he was just trying to bring so much more to the community out here. He was trying, he had big plans, getting people registered to vote to try to change the laws in Michigan so that we could get it legalized. We were running out of voter registration cards during our events back in the 90s, trying to get people registered to vote to make a change from within, because that's how he said it. He said, the only way we're going to make a difference is if we can do it from within.
Yeah. And that's true. But he also had a bit of an anti-government streak, though, wouldn't you say?
Now, honestly, I wouldn't say it was an anti-government streak. There was a lot of pressure from a prosecuting attorney that didn't have his facts in line. Just like they were trying to shut my uncle's events down at one time when he had the Ohio nonprofits sponsoring it. Well, the prosecutor never even bothered calling the nonprofit to see if it was legit. But yet it cost my uncle another $5,000 to have his lawyer go into court and fight it. And this is in the documents where my uncle's lawyer tells the prosecutor, I told my client to sue you because you guys are in the wrong. But yeah, he wants a peaceful resolution to the situation.
Right.
So he said no. Because they never even bothered to call the nonprofit to see if it was a nonprofit, but they went across the news saying, oh, Rainbow Farms are shut down for lying about a nonprofit. Once they finally had to call, because my uncle had his lawyer go to the judge, and the judge and everybody made everything go in, you know, sequence then yeah, that was retracted. And they done that every single event. They were trying to break him by bringing him into court for malicious charges throughout the entire thing. Yeah. And not only that, the police were out there harassing everybody coming in was terrified to come into Rainbow Farms back then, because there was a police brigade sitting down the street just waiting, pulling people over, searching. I mean, they were blocking people from coming before anything even ever really started to happen out here.
Yeah.
They didn't want no part of him here. And that prosecuting attorney had a vendetta against him.
Yeah, well, that seemed pretty obvious from what I was, from what I've heard and what I've read. Let me take a step back real quick. So about your uncle, I want to talk a little about his marijuana use. Was that something that he was always open about? How much do you know about how and when he started smoking weed and got into it?
Well, since my memories can remember, I remember being at my grandmother's house for Christmas dinner. My father, my Uncle Tom, my Uncle Larry, my Aunt Shirley, they all be going out to the garage and smoking. I mean, and they wouldn't, no, my grandma would not allow them to smoke in the house. But they would all congregate out there in the garage and sit out there and burn before Thanksgiving dinner, before, you know, and that was normal to me. That's how I grew up. I've always seen it out there. I'd come home from school, see my dad and his couple guys from work, you know, or even my Uncle Tom, Raleigh, and they'd all be sitting at the table smoking a joint. I'd come in, you know, no big deal. I never, it was part of, it's always been there. I've never had aspect of my life where there's not been marijuana in front of me.
Yeah.
From the time I've been born and raised.
Yeah, that's cool. That's great. So obviously the family was very accepting of his cannabis use. What about his sexuality? Was that something that your family and the community were disapproving of or accepting of? Did they know? Did they not know? What was the situation there?
A lot of people didn't know. Even today, people that were out at the farm, whenever I'm like, they were a couple, and they're like, what? I mean, they had no clue. They did not show any affection towards each other in public at all. They never did. I mean, maybe behind doors, like sitting up in the house with my Uncle Tom and Raleigh, he might reach over and rub Raleigh's shoulders or something like that to that aspect. You know what I'm saying? But to the people that wasn't really on the inside, you didn't know they were even gay.
Yeah.
You think they were roommates.
No, I guess they just wanted to keep it to themselves, you know?
And that's just it. I think that's the whole thing. I mean, my Uncle Tom was married at one time prior. And he had a great wife. They just, you know, whatever happened, happened. And they got a divorce. And, you know, my uncle asked me at one time, he's like, how do you feel about Raleigh and I and the whole gay type issue? And I said, honestly, Tom, I said, I'm not gay. I said, but what you and Raleigh choose to do is what you guys choose to do. I said, I look at Raleigh like family now. I mean, he would come to the house, me and my dad play him in horseshoes, my Uncle Tom and Raleigh. We kicked their ass one time. We'd go down to the farm. They'd pick our ass, you know. It was just good family fun. And that's how I looked at Raleigh, was like he was family. It wasn't that they were gay or anything like that. I looked at Raleigh as just like family.
Yeah. How and when did he first meet Raleigh?
That I can't tell you because I don't honestly know.
Okay.
I think Raleigh kind of came in, I want to say, in Elkhart. Back before we, you know, anybody ever moved up to Michigan and things like that. But to be honest with you, I'm not positive on that. My uncle and I didn't really start to get as close as we became until later.
Yeah.
After I got older and I started working and things like that, I'd actually asked my uncle for help one time and he said no. And I was like, okay. But then he called me up. It was about 2 weeks later. He said, well, you asked me to help you get a car. And I said, no. He said, but you're my only nephew that actually works. Maybe the other two dumbasses will learn something and see that if I help you because you're working, they'll go out and get a job.
Yeah.
So he's like, what kind of car do you want to get? You want to get a Mustang, a Trans Am, a Camaro? I'm like, yeah. He's like, no, we're going to get a Corvette.
Whoa.
I'm like, no way. I'm like, okay, whatever. He calls me up 2 weeks later. He said, boss, a guy in Elkhart got a Corvette in off the auction. You want to go check it out? He just called me up. I'm like, oh, yeah. So me and my Uncle Tom and Raleigh ride to Elkhart in their slug bug, the Beetle they had or whatever. We get into Elkhart and we're checking out the Corvette, right? It's a 1986 Corvette, the ugliest year I think they ever made. But by God, when I seen that ugly car, it was the most beautiful car I ever seen, especially when I was test driving it.
Yeah.
And so we took it for a test drive and Uncle Tom's like, what do you think? I said, yeah. He paid the guy $7,000 cash. I paid my Uncle Tom back $8,600 with interest, paying him weekly or monthly back for that car. And that's where we gained our biggest respect for each other, because he knew I wasn't trying to get things from him.
Yeah.
And he was willing to help me when I needed it. And I didn't expect to get a car like that. You know, I was like, I just needed help getting a car. But when I was 19 years old.
Yeah. What a great car to get at 19.
We went to Applebee's from the car lot. And when my Uncle Tom and Raleigh, because I drove the Corvette to Applebee's, of course, we brought it from there. And then my Uncle Tom and Raleigh walked up into Applebee's saying, Corvette kid, Corvette kid.
Man, I gotta tell you, I'm a little envious because a Corvette's my dream car, and I've never owned one. I've had a lot of cool, like, muscle cars back in the day. I had a Trans Am, I had a Le Mans, a few different cars, but I never had a Corvette. So hopefully someday, I always tell my wife my midlife crisis might include a Corvette. So be prepared. In any case, that's a cool story. So they were together for quite some time, it seems like, then. And I know that Raleigh was pretty young when they first connected. Was that at all anything controversial? I mean, he was pretty young, right? He was still a minor even, I think, actually.
I can't even begin. That's the thing. I don't know on that part because that's so young. That's back in Elkhart.
Okay.
No, wait, hang on now. I think Doug Linebach said something about Raleigh being 17.
I think that's what I read. Yeah, that he was 17. Yeah,
but that's honestly the extent of that I know of.
Yeah,
I don't know of it any further than that, and that's what Doug told me. So, but I found that out, of course, years later.
Yeah, and he was, but he was also he had already had a child at that point. I believe. Yeah, no, yeah, Raleigh had already had a son at that point.
You know, and he actually, I don't see how they could have been together at 17 because he was married. I'm pretty sure Raleigh was married to his ex-wife or his ex-girlfriend or whatever with the kid.
Yeah. Well, in any case, he definitely got married and had a kid very early, it seems like.
Yes.
Yeah.
Very early.
And Tom
was quite a bit older.
Yeah. And Tom actually helped him get custody of his son, right?
Yeah. That was to protect Robert. He wanted Raleigh to have his son because Raleigh was the better of the two parents. And I'm thankful that my Uncle Tom helped get Robert. I am. And, you know, Tom loved Robert like it was his own son. He thought of Robert like Robert was his son.
Yeah.
I mean, Tom left everything to Robert, rightfully so, because Robert deserves it.
Yeah.
And everything that was left did go to Robert.
That's good. You mentioned a moment ago Doug Linebach. Can you explain for the listeners who Doug was?
He worked for my Uncle Tom years ago, and when he was doing real estate and things like that. Linebach actually worked for a bank that gave my Uncle Tom a chance. And that's kind of how Doug Linebach and my Uncle Tom became close. And then finally, my uncle hired Doug. And Doug, he would come to our, you know, like I said, Christmas dinners. He'd be out there with my dad and my aunt and my uncle smoking weed in the garage at my grandma's, you know, during Thanksgiving, during Easter, during Christmas. You know, that's how it was. Yeah. We accepted Doug in as family also.
Yeah.
Even though Doug wasn't family, he was family. He helped me out tremendously. Even talking with him over this story and things, like I'm looking at the reports. I got them opened in front of me right now. And the last time that I went through these reports was sitting next to Doug Linebach at his table and me and him talking about everything. And I wish he could be here, but unfortunately he passed away last year.
Oh, that's a shame. Yeah, it would have been great to have him on the show with you.
It was all of a sudden, and that's been the problem with it. Everybody that's been a part of this thing is, you know, the older people that were actually a part of it, so many of them we've lost now.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little about the farm. Let's talk a little about, as far as I can tell, it seems like he purchased a farm in 1993. Does that sound about right?
Yep, that's about right.
Okay. Tell me about the property. What was it like? I know it was 34 acres.
It was corn. There was corn in the fields. It had a house with a yard, but then it was basically corn.
And did you feel like it had, I know, like you said, your uncle had many properties that he would buy and sell and fix up and whatnot. Did you get the sense that this property was different or special to him in some way, right out of the gate, or did that develop over time?
That developed over time, actually. It developed more so over time. I know Raleigh and Tom went to an event somewhere in Ohio. And I can't, I mean, honestly, I can't remember the name of it or anything like that.
Yeah.
But after they came back, my Uncle Tom was like, Raleigh, we can do this here. And then that's when their wheels started running. And then that's when they were talking. And then Doug's wheels started running. This is at the very beginning of it was, you know.
They did a lot of work on that property, right? They built stuff. They fixed stuff. Tell me a little about what went into building Rainbow Farm.
Well, they didn't want it to be a campground, and they were trying to prevent my uncle from turning it into a campground. So it was the well that they had to drill back then. It's I can't remember. It's over a $50,000 well. Because they had to have so much water, they could run all over the farm and this and that. They threw the book at my uncle trying to prevent him from actually turning this into a campground.
This was even before any of the weed stuff, right?
Oh, yeah. This is long before that. No. But if people really understand, this is also what makes my uncle kind of lose it at the end and start to go crazy because – this, like you're saying, this is back at the beginning. This is at the very early stages. They hadn't even done nothing. And they're already trying to prevent them from doing things. That's the thing. Tom had to fight them so much. It's unreal. And the prosecuting attorney threatening them the whole time.
Yeah.
And I mean threats, documented threats. There's letters that are documented. There's copies of them right in these reports right here.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about where did the name Rainbow Farm come from? What made your uncle call it Rainbow Farm?
You know, I question that now because back then if rainbow meant something with the gay community or anything like that, I had no clue, nor did anybody else really coming out to the farm.
Yeah.
Because they weren't coming out for it to be like an event that it was a gay event or nobody even thought of that.
Yeah.
So I don't think that's where they came up with it. Maybe, I don't know. I mean, I have no clue. I don't know how long they've been tying rainbows to the gay community.
Yeah. You know, I thought about that myself if there was like a double meaning because I did read online that they would see a lot of rainbows on the farm and maybe that's where they got the idea, but there could be a double meaning.
I think that's more of the thing is it's rainbows.
Yeah.
And what's weird is I've got pictures with me and my daughters even till like nowadays. I get to see the end of rainbows. Like I've got photos where you see the rainbow and you see it go all the way down right in front of you. You can see the colors right in front of my like the pictures in my phone and stuff. And it happens multiple times. And I had another phenomenon with my daughters. We were sitting at our house in my yard filled with miniature rainbows during a rainstorm. It wasn't in the sky. You could see them going all across. I told my daughters, run, take off running because they could see them. I'm like, run through the rainbows. I said, you never get another chance to do this. And they both took off running. But it's nothing I've ever seen before. So I think it has something to do with rainbows. Just like when at my Uncle Tom's funeral, everybody comes out of the funeral home and looks up at the sky to see a double rainbow.
Wow.
To me, that's what it's about. It's not about a sexuality.
Yeah.
Nothing like it's about a place. It's Rainbow Farms.
Yeah, well, it sounds like that part of Michigan just has a something special when it comes to rainbows. So that's pretty cool. I'm going to take a pause for a quick break, but please don't go away. We'll be right back with more from Boss Crossland Jr. Talking about Rainbow Farm here on Campanthropology. All right, welcome back, everybody. We are here today talking with Boss Crossland Jr., nephew of Tom Crossland, the late owner of Rainbow Farm in Michigan. So, Boss, I wanted to talk to you about the events now. We've talked about your uncle, his life. We've talked about, his relationships and how he got the property. And let's talk a little about some of the events that he held there. So I think he started holding events there around 96.
Correct.
And did you get to attend many of the events?
Oh, yeah. I was here for everyone. I wouldn't have missed them for the world. I was young, but this was my Woodstock. That's what I mean. That's what the way I felt during his events. This was like Woodstock to me, and it was no comparison to Woodstock. Let's be real. The size, you know. But to a 17-year-old kid in high school, and your uncle's throwing marijuana events, you're like, yeah, guess where I'm going this weekend, guys.
Yeah, that is pretty cool. So I know he held, they held basically two major annual events every year, which was Hemp Aid, which took place on Memorial Day weekend, and the Roach Roast, which was on Labor Day weekend. Is that right?
That is correct.
How many did they hold? How many years did it go on? Obviously, I know when it ended, but so it started in 96 or 97, we said?
Well, Summerfest was our first. That was in 96.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure Hemp Aid started also in 96, or I want to say 97. I've got all the passes here, like all my passes from the past.
Yeah.
But they're back at my house, and I'm actually in my camper. And I've got the reports here and everything with me, but I don't have my passes.
Yeah. Well, that's okay. Just,
Hemp Aid's been the longest running event.
Yeah.
That's the one that Tommy Chong showed up to. And Roach Roast, I know Roach Roast took over for something, or something took over for Roach Roast. So it was either Summerfest or something to that aspect.
Okay. Well, it's interesting. We actually, for the World of Cannabis Museum project, you know, my partner Jair and I are working on, which is, you know, sort of like what Canthropology evolved out of. We actually have quite a few keepsakes from the Rainbow Farm events and from the farm in general. Laminates, signs, flyers, matches, rolling papers, all kinds of stuff. Even a little tiny jar with some soil from the farm in it. Was that you, or was it from Doug that Jair purchased that stuff from?
Well, he didn't purchase it. I never charged Jair anything. I sent him all the flyers, and I've even got more things for him. It's things my father is still alive.
Yeah.
And that is my Uncle Tom's brother. So yeah. I have so many more things for you guys yet. I sent you guys what I could at the time. But I didn't charge. I think it was just shipping and handling, guys. That's the only thing.
Okay.
That Doug told me that was being charged, because that was Doug at the time sending everything. So
no, yeah, I didn't know if he had sent you guys some money for it or not.
I would never charge you guys for anything like that, because of what you guys are doing, preserving the history of marijuana and presenting it to people. It's something that will help my uncle's story live on forever, and that's why I'm grateful for you guys.
Oh, well, thank you. We appreciate that. I mean, that's why I do this. It's why I do what I do. It's because I've been involved with cannabis. Well, I've been smoking cannabis since I was 11 or 12, but I've been involved in cannabis professionally and cannabis media for close to 30 years now. Worked at High Times for over 20 years. And now I'm working for Leaf Magazine, and I'm doing Canthropology. And I feel like these stories, I'm not the first person to ever tell these stories, and I don't pretend that I am, but I feel like it's important to continue to tell them. And for me, Canthropology is a way to put all of the important stories in one place. So if someone wants to learn, they can go to the website, or they can pick up the magazine, and they can, you know, see all the important stories as part of a series, you know. So it's very meaningful for me to do, and I appreciate the words of support, and I'm also very thankful to be able to talk to people like you to tell the story. So let's continue talking about the events. Tell us some of the memories from the events that stand out in your mind. Any funniest moments, favorite moments, or craziest shit that went down?
Some of the funniest moments. I may have been partying a little too much, and I found myself butt naked up at the top of the hippie slide, sliding down. But in my defense, I went the furthest. The hard part was the next morning when I wake up at home, and at this time I still live with my parents, and my Uncle Tom shows up for coffee first thing in the morning, because he'd always come down to the house, because we lived up in Vandalia and Cass also at the time, where my Uncle Tom lived. So during the events, he'd come down to the house, sit there, have some coffee with my dad. He was always up early, and I kept hearing my dad and my Uncle Tom laughing their fucking ass off. I mean, laughing. And I come downstairs, and about the time I got downstairs, I remembered last night. My Uncle Tom said, don't worry, I got it on videotape. You'll see it again sometime.
Oh, man. You guys had a lot of big celebrities and performers come through over the years. You mentioned Tommy Chong earlier. I know also John Sinclair was there. I know that members of Normal, Merle Haggard performed, Big Brother in the Holding Company. Lots of big name performers. Did you get to meet and mingle with these guys? Did you get to hang out with them and smoke with them?
Oh, yeah. The most... And this goes back to the Corvette story. The most memorable for me was I come to my uncle's house and I left straight from work on a Friday and I had my Corvette because I knew Tommy Chong was coming. So I get to the house and my Uncle Tom, me, Raleigh, Tommy Chong, his two kids go up to the house and we sit there and Raleigh had a new bubbler. And it was somebody from High Times there, okay? Chris Conrad, maybe, or something like that?
Chris Conrad has written for High Times. He didn't work for High Times, but he did write. Yeah. I know Steve Hager went there for the events.
Whoever it was, it was either Super Silver Haze
or
White Widow that won a Cannabis Cup that year.
Nice.
And it was in a silver bag, and they cut it open, and it was like when the bags first started coming out with that, and you couldn't smell them. They're like, check this out. You know, everybody's smelling the bag. Oh, I can't smell anything. And then they cut open the bag, and then the room just filled with great smell. But we sat there, and I got to smoke with Tommy Chong and his two sons. And I don't even think my Uncle Tom was even smoking at the time, because there was times where he just didn't smoke. Of course, there's times he was on probation for it, but still. He just didn't smoke.
Yeah.
And we all sat there and smoked. I left my uncle's house to go home to get a shower. And I was driving that Corvette and the cops pulled me over. Not even, I don't know, 300 feet after pulling out of the driveway from Rainbow Farms. Oh. I had the cops light me up and I'm like, oh shit. So I pull over. The cops come up to my car and they're like, what are you doing? So, well, I'm leaving my uncle's house. He's got an event going on this weekend. License and registration. Gave him a license and registration. Mind you, everybody going in and out of Rainbow Farms, the cops pull over, they're searching their cars. So mind you, I'm sweating bullets right now because, of course, I got weed with me. And the cop comes back up. And he said, take your air freshener off of your mirror. You can go.
Wow.
And I'm thinking to myself, I'm 19 years old, driving a Corvette, told him my uncle's having an event. And he didn't care. He's like, you can go. That blew my mind. I, till this day, I never really fully understood it. But my uncle at one time, like I said, he'd come down to the house, sit and have coffee with my dad. Told my dad, as we're sitting at the table, it's costing me $5,000 to $10,000 before each event. I don't understand what he was saying with that. Doug Linebot told me that's how much it's costing him in court costs. Before, like I was telling you how they take him to court for the malicious charges. That's how much it was costing him was $5,000 to $10,000 before each event. I took it as he was paying off the people because, I mean, I've gotten pulled over multiple times in Michigan and never had a single problem with them. Not one. Every time they let me go. Wow. No questions. No, didn't ask to search my car, nothing.
That's lucky. You're very lucky.
Until the standoff.
Yeah. I was actually working at High Times. High Times held one of their events there, the WE Festival, which stood for World Hemp Expo Extravaganza. I was working at High Times at the time. I started working at High Times in 94. And I remember I didn't get to go to the event. I wasn't... they weren't going to pay for some young kid who was working there to fly out for the event. But but I did hear about it and everything. And I remember when we covered it in the magazine. And then High Times ended up naming Rainbow Farm one of the top 25 stoner travel spots in the world, which must have been pretty exciting for your uncle.
That blows my mind.
Yeah,
I mean, even to me, that blows my mind. Because to me, this was it was like a regular barbecue that we would have every, you know, any time, you know, it's just on a bigger platform.
Yeah.
That's how they always were. They didn't do anything different than live their life, but with a bunch of other people.
Yeah. And I know that these events became the center of cannabis activism in Michigan. Other than, like, speeches that were given on stage, what kind of activism was going on? You guys were doing, like, voter initiatives and petitions and stuff, right?
Correct. And they were – their main thing was getting people registered to vote. That, I mean, they – like Tom would tell them, and everybody that was out here speaking upon cannabis, you know, we can't change it by ourselves. We're going to have to change it from within if we're going to get it to change. And there was events where we would run out of voter registration cards, getting people in the state of Michigan registered to vote. That's why I think that they had a bigger role in the legalization than what people really realize in Michigan, because I mean, tens of thousands of people, they had to get registered to vote throughout their events.
Yeah. How many people typically came to the events? I know it would vary from event to event, but what would you say, like, average number of people?
I'd say a couple thousand on average.
Yeah.
I mean, it was never huge until, like, we started getting Tommy Chong, and they had the Birds. You know, they had different groups in, but it just didn't get that huge until Tommy Chong, and then, you know.
Were the events profitable? Did they make money?
Not as much as people think. I mean, back then, my Uncle Tom was charging $65 for a weekend camping pass. $65.
Yeah.
And that was camping and everything included, you know?
Yeah.
They got the camp. That, by the time you figure the cost of the entertainment, the amount of bands he had coming in here, he had so many different bands coming here. And then you figure the cost of getting to the event, like I was saying, with the court cost, because when the prosecutor takes you to court, you got to go to court. If he's falsely charging you or not, your lawyer still has to go to court.
Yeah, sure.
And the judge has to clear you. Every year they would say, oh, Rainbow Farms got shut down. Every single year you would see it, you hear it on the radio or you'd see it on the news, Rainbow Farms events got shut down. Malcolm Tom's like, no, they haven't. But that's what they were doing, trying to prevent him from getting people here, just like with the cop show of force, trying to prevent people from coming in. They didn't want people to make that change.
Yeah.
They didn't want...
Well, he had to know that throwing these events, these pro-pot events and doing the activism he was doing was probably going to piss off law enforcement and draw some attention. I would assume he would know that.
Of course he knew that. But the thing was, is he wasn't selling anything. Never. And when if they caught people out here with nitrous tanks and shit like that, or methamphetamines, which wasn't even a thing back then. But if they were caught out here with shit like that, they got ejected. And they'd take their nitrous tank up on right on stage and crack the valve open and release all the gas in front of people, in front of the stage, and say, look, we don't want this shit here. I've watched him fucking do it.
Yeah, he was against hard drugs, right?
Yes, he was against hard drugs. But just like any concert you go to in the United States or anything like that, you're still going to have people that come in that are going to be selling it out of their backpacks or whatever they're doing. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, of course, yeah.
And all you can do is try to prevent it. But you can't stop it all. But it's what was sold here was no worse than what's going on anywhere in the United States then or even now today.
Yeah.
And it wasn't him condoning it.
And he wasn't doing anything illegal, though. The concerts, the festivals themselves, he wasn't breaking the law, right? There was nothing he was doing that was breaking the law.
No, his vendors were clothing vendors and food vendors.
Yeah, but it was this one specific cop, the Cass County prosecutor named Scott Teeter, that really just had it out for him from the beginning, right? It seemed like he tried various legal filings to try to shut it down, like you touched on earlier. In 1997, he filed an injunction claiming he violated the the gathering of people in excess of $500, but your uncle beat that by making the nonprofit. And then the next year, he tried something else, and when those failed, he established a drug task force and started sending narcs in to try to bust people selling weed, but he could never tie it back to your uncle. He could never tie any of the drugs back to him.
Because there was no, he was never tied in with them. They thought of my uncle as this big kingpin monopolizing off of drugs and his property, but he wasn't. He was giving people a peaceful place to gather.
Yeah, and entertainment and educating them about legalization.
Exactly. Yeah. That's it. But they wanted him to be so much more.
So how did your Uncle Tom respond to Teeter's tactics, to all this stuff? How did he respond? I read that he sent some letters of his own, didn't he?
I was gonna respond on a letter that he sent to Teeter, and it was about 97, 98-ish. And my Uncle Tom told Scott Teeter, he said, "My family and I do not take your threats lightly. So how should we expect our deaths? Are you going to snipe us off like you did those at Ruby Ridge? Or are you going to burn us out like you did those at Waco?" That's one of the letters that my uncle sent Teeter 2 years prior to my uncle getting sniped and Raleigh getting burned out of a house.
Yeah. And he said to him, didn't he say to him that we are all prepared to die on this land before we allow it to be stolen from us?
Yes, he did.
Yeah. So, so eventually, unfortunately, despite your uncle legally outmaneuvering the prosecutor on several occasions, he kept at it, and eventually they found their excuse to come in and raid the place. So from what I read online, it was on April 20th that the Rainbow Farm held a festival, and then the next day there was some 17-year-old kid who had attended the festival who was wearing the wristband and from the festival, and he crashed into a school bus full of kids, and none of the kids were seriously injured, but the driver was killed, and then he had weed in his bloodstream, the police said. And so you think that was probably like the last straw where they were like, okay, now we gotta go in and do something?
No, I don't think that was the last straw, because they tried to get Tom for that. And they cleared him of all wrongful doings on that.
Well, it was 3 weeks after that accident that they raided the farm, though, right?
That is correct. But when they went into the farm, they raided the farm on a possible tax invasion. They woke my uncle up in bed sleeping, him and Raleigh, at 3 a.m. in the morning with rifles pointed at their heads, looking for business documents. Of course, the agents went to the basement and found marijuana growing. That's when they put my Uncle Tom and Raleigh in handcuffs outside of the house, called into Kalamazoo, had them issue another warrant for the marijuana that they were growing, and arrested them for that. But what they went in there for was a possible tax invasion, which was completely clear. We're completely clear on that.
Yeah, and I read there was some like lady who was an informant who had like told the police that she worked for them and they were paying their employees off the books or something like that, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
That's what she did. But the thing is they had all documentation for everything. There was nothing. That was their way to get inside. That was their excuse. That was Peter's excuse to go into my uncle's house.
Sure. It was a trumped up warrant. It was trumped up so he could get in. Yeah.
And that's all it was. That was their way of getting in because they knew he had plants in his basement at that time. You know what's messed up is I was supposed to get clones from them plants. I was supposed to actually go pick up some of them plants.
Oh boy.
That's what you know.
So he had about a little over 200 plants, something like that, right?
Yeah,
quite a few. So Tom and Raleigh were both arrested, charged with felony cultivation, possession, weapons charges, and they charged with running a drug house, which is a little weird. But
the plants were 3 inches tall.
Oh, they were just they were just babies.
They were little big babies. They didn't even have no THC factor, nothing.
Wow. But regardless of that, he was facing, with all the charges, he was facing up to 20 years in prison.
Correct.
But unfortunately, the prison was only the beginning because the court also issued an injunction banning any more events on the property.
Correct.
They filed a complaint based on evidence of drug sales to try to seize the farm under drug asset forfeiture law. Mm-hmm. And possibly worst of all, on May 15th, I guess Teeter had Robert, their son, who was now 12 years old at the time, taken away by Child Protective Services and placed in foster care. That's pretty terrible.
And you know what's awful? And this is something else for people to really look into. Look at Scott Teeter's role. Even after people wouldn't re-elect him for a prosecuting attorney after he killed my uncle, they appointed him on child welfare stuff like this, where he's getting kickbacks, because I've got documents on that too.
Wow.
Yeah, the same guy. Trust me, there's paperwork in here for some reason on Jackson County, Michigan or something like that, where 50% of the kids were removed out of households for basically marijuana and charges on parents. And 50% of the kids were removed from the house in that township and put up for adoption.
Wow.
And this is back in the 90s. I've read so much stuff through this. And just like today, I was going through stuff like I told you. I really wanted to get you pictures. But then I'm reading through the dispatch reports where they're joking about the whole theme from the beginning. Wow. The police, the state police, they're all joking about it. But the thing is they never even bothered to call Rainbow Farms to ask them what's going on.
Yeah.
They joked about, did you call? No, I didn't call. Did somebody else call? We haven't called them. We don't know. Well, don't you guys think you should call? I don't know. Should we call? I mean, this is in the dispatch reports. There are discussions on the whole situation, but they were staging already at the time. They've already contacted the state police by this point. They're already staging, and nobody's even bothered to try to make contact to find out what's really going on.
Wow. You know, of all the terrible things that the government has done to weed smokers over the decades, I think that the most terrible is probably taking children away from families, because to assume that someone is a bad parent simply because they smoke weed and that they're incapable of caring for their child is
so wrong.
Incredibly false and fucked up. And you know, you can lose a house, you can spend a few years in jail, but to lose your child has got to be the most— I don't have children, but to lose a child has to be probably the most painful thing, I think.
I mean, that's got to be the worst. I agree by far. Because not only is our government fucking up the lives of the two parents, but they're also fucking up the life of that poor child.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's putting it blunt. They're hurting the families, but at the same time, they're looking at the dollar signs that they can make. Well, you got to go take these classes now before you can get your kid back. You got to go take our classes that we're going to charge you a couple thousand dollars for. So, you know,
yeah,
that's all it is. And that's our government allowing the police and them to use basically our own kids as hostages against parents.
Yeah. I remember as a kid in the 80s when they had the DARE program and they would try to get kids in school to narc on their parents. Oh, if your parents are smoking weed, you better tell us because, you know, they're doing something wrong. I mean, I would never do that. I would never tell on my parents.
My dad told me, he's like, you don't ever tell people about what I do here.
Yeah.
And that's— I mean, I remember that from growing up. That's just something my father told me. This ain't nobody else's business. You don't tell your school. And because my parents had learned how to deal with that, because I was born in 79. So the mid late 80s, I was in that program. I got the shirts.
Yeah.
the black with white lettering with the big red circle with the line going across it. The drugs, you know? I got the shirt.
Those are collector's items now.
That's crazy, though. That's, That is crazy.
Yeah. Well, we gotta laugh a little bit because it's very sad and fucked up stuff that we were talking about. But you do have to, try to keep your head up about it. But so despite everything that was thrown at them, Tom apparently went ahead and scheduled more events, even in defiance of the court order. He had like a gathering in the middle of August, and then scheduled another event for the end of August. Why do you think he did that? He already knew he was in a lot of trouble. Do you think he was just like, fuck it, I don't care anymore? Or?
Well, it kind of goes back to, like I was telling you earlier, whenever Tom took the handgun to the car wash and took his weekly pay out of the cash register box and walked out. He believes in his rights. And that's what it was. He believes in his rights. He knew he wasn't hurting nobody. He wasn't breaking the law. He was trying to get bad drugs out of here. He didn't want that shit in here. If the cops were doing their jobs on the streets, that shit would have never made its way into here.
Well, at one of these gatherings that he had that August, and that apparently there were a couple of undercovers in there, and he offered one of them a hit off of his pipe, and unfortunately that led to Teeter, the prosecutor, petitioning to have their bail revoked, and he scheduled the hearing for that on August 31st. And this was kind of the beginning of the end for Tom and Raleigh and Rainbow Farm, from everything I read online. They kind of knew it, or at least Tom did. What are your thoughts?
Tom, like I said, I was real close with Michael Tom. My father was close to Michael Tom. You see reports about a 50 caliber rifle. Those are true.
Yeah.
And he brought it down to my father's house to sight it in. And my dad and I sat there at the picnic table after they left. And we said, we don't want to see other people get hurt. I understand why my Uncle Tom's lost his mind by this point, because they're getting ready to take everything from him when he was never doing what they're... He was never the supplier. He was never the kingpin. That was them not doing their jobs on the outside, keeping the shit from getting in. He was losing his mind. They'd taken Robert. And when he comes down to the house after he left, my dad talked to me. And I said, I don't want to see innocent people get hurt either, Dad. And we called Cass County Police Department. Mind you, Tom's not allowed to have a gun.
Yeah.
Because of the armed robbery charge. Anyways, we called them trying to prevent my uncle from getting killed because of his rage and anger, because of him having no other option than what they're giving him to fight for his land. But we didn't want to see an innocent officer get killed or hurt by doing their job by going to the situation either.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, it's that old, proverb of he was like a wounded animal backed into a corner at this point.
At this point, that's how Tom was acting. Yeah. And at the same time, we didn't want to see it escalate where it got. So we tried to stop it a month or two before it happened.
Yeah. So I need to take another quick commercial break. But definitely don't go anywhere, guys, because when we come back, we're going to talk about how it all ended and what went down. The siege of Rainbow Farm. So please stick around, and we'll be right back here on Campbell Project. All right, welcome back to Canthropology, everyone. My guest this episode is Boss Crossland Jr., nephew of Tom Crossland, who was the owner and operator of Rainbow Farm, who was unfortunately killed by federal officers 22 years ago this month. When we last left off before the break, the police had taken Tom and his partner Raleigh's son away. They were filing paperwork to take his farm away. They had prevented him from holding any more events, and he was facing 20 years in prison. There wasn't much hope, it seemed like. And unfortunately, it seems like that led Tom to make some desperate decisions. So during the week of the last week of August, Tom and Raleigh apparently wrote up some wills, like handwrote some wills, leaving all their possessions to their son Robert, and started giving stuff away from the farm to whoever was there and wanted it. Right? Were you there when this was going on at all?
No, I was not there at that time. At that time, I was actually starting to kind of get my life going. I was afraid because of everything that had happened. I'd seen my uncle come to the house. I'd seen his eyes. I knew how he felt, but there was nothing anybody could do. So I didn't want to be there because at the time I had a girlfriend who was pregnant and who ended up being my wife. But I knew my uncle had lost it by that point. Now, he gave everything away. He gave everything out of the farm. As I was telling you, I've got things for you guys. And I can't wait for it to be in your guys' display because they're very personal and I want them to live forever. So,
yeah.
Well. But when everything was going on, I knew it was happening. I ran down there. I seen the signs. There was people holding signs up. Ruby Ridge, Waco, who's next? You know?
Well, he knew. I mean, like, this is something that was in his mind that he was going to do. I mean, I read that he left a note in an old house he was renovating in downtown that read, in part, the action we must take now is not what we wanted. We would have preferred a peaceful end. The government must be stopped. Scott Teeter knew what was coming. We need to protect. We need protection from the people we hired to protect us. Let the battle begin. He was about to go to battle, and he knew it.
He knew it. He had no other option, though.
Yeah,
it was either go to prison for the rest of your life, or fight for your life.
So they never showed up to that. They never showed up for that court appearance on the 31st. Instead, they kicked out all the campers that were on the property and started setting fire to the structures on the farm, right?
Yep, that's correct. But there's more to that as also. Just like my Uncle Tom had contacted his lawyer at the time, who went to school, come to find out, with Scott Teeter. And my uncle contacts his lawyer and he's like, look, we need to get an extension to this court date. Oh, no, you'll be fine. They're not going to do anything. You can go to court today. You're going to be, mind you, he's going to lose everything. And his lawyer, oh, no, you're going to be fine. Trying to just make it easy for him to go in there and accept them taking everything. But, I mean, that's one of Scott Teeter's threats in the letters back to my Uncle Tom, telling him, I'm going to take everything you own. He threatened it multiple times.
Yeah.
It was a vendetta. Neither one of those two guys would. I mean, they were very similar, if you ask me. In their beliefs, they were very similar people. Neither one of those two guys would back down in what they believe.
Yeah.
Teeter wouldn't back down. Tom wouldn't back down. Teeter just had more pull.
Well, he had the power of the government behind him, so yeah.
Yeah, but you know, he got lucky as well. I know he got lucky because I know Tom wanted to kill him. I know that for a fact.
Well, I mean, at that point, he was already looking at 20 years and lost everything. I guess what's another sentence on top of that, right? What's a murder sentence on top of that?
Well, all I can say is it's a good thing Teeter worked late that day because he wouldn't be around today.
Wow.
And I found that out later, of course, down the road after everything. I found out everything that they planned because Tom was at war, not with the police, not with the – actually, the state police were already at war with them because Doug Linebach had told me about letters from the state police saying, what are you pickle suckers going to be doing when the bullets are flying by your head?
Oh, man.
I'm being honest.
Yeah.
And that's exactly how Doug put it to me. And to be honest, I know I got a family member that has our original hard drive from my uncle's computers.
Yeah.
It's been hid away for, like you said, 22 years. And if it's able to be brought back up, or compatible again. I'm going to try to find out by the end of this year. I've already talked with people on this.
Yeah.
I've got the original hard drive and the computer from Rainbow Farms. That might give us more answers. I don't know.
Yeah.
I just know the state police were anti. If I say gay, am I going to be penalized? I don't even know what it's. I mean,
yeah, no.
I don't know what to call them. I just know they were whatever.
Homophobic. No, I mean the police were homophobic.
Yes, they were homophobic with them guys. Yeah. And that's one thing Doug, he said there's a couple letters on their hard drive from the state police. He said they couldn't prove it came from the state police, but trust me, if I can bring up that original hard drive, I imagine nowadays they could bring that shit right up and find out. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But that's just more, and just like going through the, like I told you earlier, dispatch, all the way up to the state police joking about it, all of them, just it was a joke to them.
Yeah.
They didn't even care. It wasn't lives at stake.
It's fucked up. The cops, the way that they've treated cannabis activists and users throughout our history has always been fucked up.
Well, whenever you want me to, I will tell you exactly what I feel happened up there. And I will tell you why I feel the way it happened when Tom was killed. And then I will tell you exactly what happened with Raleigh.
All right. Well, we're getting to that right now. So let me just lay out a few more facts and then let me have it. So I just want to
make sure. I didn't want to jump ahead of my schedule here. On
I just wanted to.
It's something that it's the only thing that makes sense.
Yeah. Well, let's just build up to that because I want everybody who's listening to know how the events transpired. So he started setting fire to the buildings on the land, presumably because if the government was going to get his land, he wanted to make sure that they didn't get anything. They got the bare minimum. They wouldn't get anything of value. And then, I from what I understand, seeing the smoke, some neighbors must have called 911 to report the fire.
Right.
And police believed they got an anonymous tip that the fires were an ambush that he was waiting for them. So they didn't come in right away. They kind of waited around. And then this is what really set things off was a local TV news chopper flew overhead to get footage of the fires. And Tom shot at it and hit it with a few bullets. Maybe he thought it was a police chopper or maybe he didn't care. I don't know. But that seems to be what triggered them calling in the FBI because shooting at a chopper is a federal offense, correct?
Correct. And, you know, here's the thing about the whole shooting of the helicopter. There was Tom plus at least two other people, maybe more here, at that time of the helicopter flying over. Now, if you're part of a standoff and one guy's shooting at a helicopter, don't you think that, well, more than likely, the other two are going to be shooting at it as well. So, as far as I can tell, I know Tom's shot wasn't that great, but that's fine because Tom did take the blame for it. Because when they allowed my father to come back in on, I think it was Friday, to talk to my Uncle Tom the day the standoff began. And my Uncle Tom told my dad, I apologize for shooting the news helicopter. He said, I thought it was the state police helicopter. He apologized for shooting a news helicopter. He thought it was because it was blue and white.
Yeah.
News 16, just like a state police helicopter up here. And but my question to that is, why would they allow a news helicopter to fly over a land that they're not willing to even drive back to check out? They've got a freaking station set up 3-4 miles down the road from Rainbow Farms. So why would they allow a news helicopter to fly over it if they're not willing to drive back and check out the situation?
So you think it was recon? You think they sent it there for recon?
100%. 100%. Honestly, why would they allow, if they're not willing to allow the fire trucks to come back and inspect the fires to see what's really going, because they hadn't called Tom. They haven't called Rainbow Farms at all, and that's in the dispatch reports. as they're joking about the whole situation.
Yeah. They're
joking about it, but nobody even bothered to call the farm to see what's really going on. They listen to everybody else instead of trying to make that first contact themselves. They just listen to them people, set up a station down the road, and then allowed a news helicopter to go over to get recon for them. And it got shot at because the situation's a lot deeper than what that news helicopter should have been ever allowed to fly over.
Yeah. Do you think, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the way you were phrasing it earlier, it sounded like you didn't actually believe it was your uncle that shot the copter, that maybe somebody else did it.
I believe somebody else hit the helicopter. The name I'm not going to say, but okay. I know my uncle shot was not that good.
Okay. So you think he just accepted the blame for it because he didn't want someone else to get the blame for it.
Exactly. That's it right there.
Okay.
That's what it is. There was no investigation to find out. He told that to my dad. My dad told me that. I told everybody else that because that's what I was told from my uncle. But at the same time, do I believe it? No, because he's not that good a shot.
Yeah. So this all began on, like I said, the 31st, which was a Friday, and then that weekend was Labor Day weekend. And so throughout the next couple of days, they burned down all the structures pretty much except for the farmhouse, right? And they basically hunkered down in the farmhouse. I read that they had a friend named Buggy bringing them food in and out and stuff. And
that's the thing. That's questionable too when you say friend, because I always kind of accepted Buggy as a friend as well. But the thing is he was part of a book called 12 Monkeys. And it's where the FBI went in and took over like monk's sanctuary place that was robbing people and shit somehow. And they used a 13-year-old kid named, let's call him Buggy, as their inside person.
Really?
Really.
And your uncle didn't know this, right, about him?
Well, no, a lot of people don't know this. And just like Ole Olafson, the guy that still owns Bivouac, or what I call Bivouac down here, that allowed the FBI to set up, that's where Buggy was living.
So you think he was working with the cops, and that's why he was coming in and out?
I do think so. I really do. And I don't want to say, because I liked Buggy, but he was weird. And I come to find out, I got pointed out a couple things by another person that really started investigating the story, and he's like, you know, Buggy was part of that 12 Monkeys group, or that 12 Monkeys book, or something like that. And I'm like, what? And he started explaining to me, or maybe it's Ole and him. It might be both. I don't know, but Ole worked as for my Uncle Tom as a lawyer, just writing up documents and things for court, and then allowed the FBI to use their property for their headquarters. State police.
Wow.
Everybody. Well, so it's weird to me on that aspect. Yeah.
Well, it's been reported that on Sunday, September 2nd, the police reportedly brought in some of Tom's family, friends, and attorneys to try to bring him a cell phone to negotiate. And they reported that the police vehicle was fired upon, that he didn't want to talk to the police, and that he fired on the loudspeakers that they were using to talk to him. He also reportedly shot at police planes and sprayed shots into the woods. Does that sound like something your uncle would do?
Well, back then I would have said yes. But I don't know if he did it like they're saying. I mean, yes, I do believe they fired upon the cars and things like that.
It sounds like he was trying to just shoot things, not people. It didn't sound like he was trying to kill anybody. No, he was just shooting vehicles and speakers and stuff.
He knew he couldn't reach them. He was just showing his aggression at that time, per se. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But at the same time, Tom felt backed into a corner so bad. You know, like I told you, school lunches. You know, the mayor for Vandalia one year come to my Uncle Tom not during the standoff, but maybe a year or two prior, and said, Tom, we don't have money for the kids in Vandalia this year. We don't have money for them for Christmas. So my Uncle Tom went down to the Dollar General, bought every kid in Vandalia a $5 gift and $5 cash he put with them, with their gift. So every kid in Vandalia at least got a gift and $5 in cash that year. This man did so much good.
Yeah.
But then they pushed this man, the same man that's done nothing but good and wanting to help the community. Now they've taken this guy's kid, which obviously he's supporting that kid and can show that kid and give him whatever he needs. He's doing it for the whole community. But they take that guy's kid because of marijuana? That's ridiculous. I don't care if it's illegal back then or not. It's not that bad. I mean, even back then, people can tell it's not that bad of a drug. It's sure. not that bad of a drug.
Sure.
And I don't even consider it a drug.
Yeah.
I really don't.
No.
Caffeine probably has more effect on people and bad effects on people throughout sure. the day than what marijuana does.
Yeah, for sure.
And I don't understand it. That's yeah. one of the hardest, especially Michigan now being legalized.
Well, thankfully things have been changing finally. So that's, we are making yeah. good, we're heading in the right direction finally after, yeah. after many, many decades. But, just yeah. to go back to the farm. So Sunday yeah. night, from what I read, three FBI sniper teams were sent to set up a perimeter around the property. They were camouflaged. They were hiding in the woods. And then the next day on Monday, September 3rd, Tom had wanted to speak to the media, but they wouldn't let him. And he finally agreed to speak to police on Monday with a phone that Buggy brought in, apparently. And he told the FBI that he and Raleigh wanted to speak to Robert, but the FBI refused to let him speak to their son. And he cursed at them and hung up. And then later that afternoon, Tom reportedly was armed with a rifle, and he had walked over to a neighbor's house for supplies, is what it said. And then on his way back to the farmhouse, he allegedly spotted one of the FBI snipers lying on the ground and allegedly raised his rifle, at which point the snipers opened fire, and he was killed instantly.
I got to ask you.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Please, go ahead. Please.
This thing's burning a hole in my brain right now.
Go.
In what you read, does it report a name by the name of Brandon Peoples walking with my uncle now at this point?
There was somebody else mentioned as being with him. Yeah, I believe you. Okay. That was probably the name, yeah.
Okay. So this guy supposedly walked right by the police brigade and snuck on the property. All right. I've talked with the guy I can call the guy that was here Friday, Saturday, and left Saturday night during the standoff, and they never caught him here. I'm good friends with that guy. He's a great guy. He's an old guy, but I know for a fact he was here. And then the day he left, this Brandon Peoples sneaks in on the property. Now, mind you, I never met this guy. I have no clue who he is. Everybody at Rainbow Farms really has no clue who he really was. Now he sneaks on, and he's here during the standoff, supporting my Uncle Tom and Raleigh, whatever, supposedly. And my Uncle Tom leaves after cussing him out on the phone, like you said. That's in the reports. It's yeah. right there, just like you said. He left to escort Brandon Peoples off of the property. And he went to Butchie's first, which is the blue house right down the street.
Okay.
He picked up a coffee pot, I think maybe cigarettes, something like that. So now they said, my Uncle Tom picks up all this stuff. He's carrying it back.
Well, so was he? So he was carrying a coffee pot and a rifle, you're saying, at the same time?
Yeah. The rifle was on like a strap, you know, across okay. his back.
Yeah.
Yep. Of course, mind you, Tom's one carrying all this stuff still, guys. Tom hears a noise. He goes up on this hill. Brandon Peoples directly behind my Uncle Tom. They shoot my Uncle Tom in the head. But mind you, before that gunshot rings out, Tom in his left hand, in which people don't realize is Tom is left-handed, which don't coincide with the FBI reports because they didn't realize that. They don't look at things like that, but Tom was left-handed. And one of the FBI report, like agents on that scene, reports that Tom radios to Raleigh incoming, and then the gunshot. Tom never pointed a gun. Tom radioed to Raleigh and told him incoming because he did spot the agents. Now, mind you, there's this guy directly behind my Uncle Tom. They shoot my uncle in the head. My uncle's at the highest point of the hill out in this area. The guy behind him, which is Brandon Peoples, is on the lower side of the hill back behind him. In the reports, it states that he didn't see anything because he was bent down tying his shoe. But that's kind of funny because my Uncle Tom's skull and brain fragments were cleaned out of his eyes at the hospital. So how do you explain that it goes and curves down into his face when the FBI agent's on the other side of the hill shooting up at my uncle's head?
So what are you insinuating? What do you think that this Brandon person was doing?
I don't know. I have no clue.
You're just saying it's fishy.
It's very fishy, but you know what's more fishy is in the report it states that Tom radios to Raleigh and tells him incoming. That same walkie-talkie has blood splatter marks on it. It's not drenched in blood like it's in a pocket after they shot him 20 times. It's not like that. It's like it's in his hand. And if they shot my uncle in the head right then, whenever he says incoming, Raleigh's on that walkie-talkie. His head goes back. That walkie-talkie is going to shoot in front of him from the force of his head going back. That's going to leave the blood splatter marks on there and the dirt that covers the blood splatter marks, okay?
Yeah.
Now, this gets us into where Raleigh's killed, guys, because Raleigh's agreed to turn himself in. They're bringing Robert in at like 7 o'clock in the morning, and Raleigh gets to tell him goodbye before he goes to prison or to jail. That's already agreed upon in the reports, agreed upon. But then about 3 o'clock in the morning, they start shooting rubber bullets through the house. And then around 4 o'clock, they shot a flash canister in the upstairs of the residence. That flash canister started a fire.
Raleigh's see, I didn't see anything. I didn't see anything in my research about the flash canister.
I know you don't, but I got it. And that's what caught that house on fire. Now, as the house is burning down, Raleigh has no choice but to go outside because the house is burning down. Where else are you going to go? Well, when he goes outside, they said due to the smoke, they thought he was pointing a gun. And you got to read every single report on each and every single agent to get this copy of this stuff. That's the problem. There's over 5,000 pages to this book. I mean, it's huge. I'm talking books upon books of information. But that's okay. So Raleigh comes out of the house. Okay. Now they shoot at Raleigh saying they thought he was pointing a gun. At this time, to be honest with you, I don't even think he had a gun in his hand. When they shot Raleigh, he was not fatally wounded, okay? He was injured. The ambulance is sitting not even two blocks down the street. They put Raleigh in handcuffs and let him lay on the ground and bleed to death before they allowed the ambulance back to him.
So he wasn't killed immediately. He wasn't killed right away.
No. They let him lay on the ground for 41 minutes and bleed to death because Raleigh was talking to my Uncle Tom on the walkie-talkie. That's what people don't realize. That was straight fucking murder on Raleigh. Would my uncle have backed down? Fuck no. Fuck no. He would not have backed down. But Raleigh was murdered. Straight the fuck up murdered.
Yeah, and they want to.
That's how I honestly feel.
Yeah, they want to say that he started the fire and that he came out with a rifle and that he was like trying to finish what Tom started, like, you know, going out in a blaze of glory or whatever. That's how they're trying to frame it.
The blow. They had to be in there before they even burned it down. because there was so much propane in that fucking house. My dad went in there. There was tripwires. Friday, my dad went in there. My Uncle Tom told my dad, don't step on that wire right there going into the house. The basement had, I mean, 100-pound tanks of propane in the basement lined up. But all that was diffused before the house was burnt down. So I don't know everything. I just know that Tom radioed Raleigh before they shot my uncle in the head. And this, and like right now, it's hard for me to go through this because I've known a lot of this for years. But every time I go through it, I keep piecing together more,
yeah,
and more and more. And I would love to send you these documents sometime. I mean, actually mail you the whole briefcase I got here. And let you actually take a look at everything in here. And, you know, I think that would be the best bet. That way you could get a better understanding. Is there's timelines I've got drawn up in here with the different reports. Reels Network. I did a thing with Reels.
Yeah.
I let them use all this.
Yeah, I saw that. Yeah.
But the FBI got a hold of them by the end. Whenever they went to air it, like I told them, I said, you guys are going to chicken out. The day it was supposed to air, they backed out. They didn't air it. The lady, I called her up finally about a month later. She said, I'm not sure why they pulled it, but they're going to air it sometime. They did after they met with FBI agents and they tried to change everything around.
So, I mean, it seems obvious to me that Tom went into this kind of knowing he was going to die. He said he was going to die defending his property, but you don't think that's the case with Raleigh. Raleigh was not like intent on dying. You think that he would have given up.
He would have, especially after Thomas killed. That's why he agreed, but they wouldn't allow him to. You want to know why? Because if Raleigh's able to tell my family that Tom was murdered while talking to him on a walkie-talkie, they couldn't take this land then and do what they did. They had to kill Tom and Raleigh to be able to take this land because Robert is in protective custody at the time. That's how they divided this property up into six different pieces and auctioned it all off.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you, you know, yeah. In the aftermath of the siege, what actually happened to the property? Did they did confiscate it, huh?
Yes, they took it. And, you know, just like Peter said, he was going to take every dime from my Uncle Tom that he had. And they done that. Just like bringing his family's realtor company in, divide the property up. They took every dime that Tom had except for maybe $30,000 that was left for Robert. And that's including the houses in Elkhart and everything else, the mansion. You know, it's ridiculous.
Which had nothing to do with, would not bought with the gains of any kind of drug, anything. They were, yeah.
He was fighting to do the events with the money that he got from the events.
Yeah.
At $65 a ticket, guys, that's not very much. Especially with the entertainment, and it was a whole weekend full of entertainment. It wasn't no like BS where you got two bands on one day with dry sound coming. It was every day, all day, bands playing.
So they took the property, they broke it up, and they sold it. Especially, particularly because I know that Teeter wanted to prevent any future owners from continuing, you know, Tom and Raleigh's legacy of throwing festivals and cannabis stuff there. But I actually read online that in 2012, the farm was purchased by someone named Gary Healy, who apparently renamed it the New Rainbow Farm and is honoring or says he was going to honor the tradition of what it stood for. Whatever happened, what's going on with the farm now today?
All right. So the farm was auctioned off to multiple people. And whenever the guy that said something about doing a big time movie about it, some big time producer, he met with the family and everything. And a gentleman by the name of Gary Healy come to our house. And he was in the process of buying the property on land contract from a guy that purchased the property from the estate, like sale type thing, I guess. Well, on the original contract with the people that bought each piece of property, it states that they cannot turn it into a campground. They can't throw events, nothing like that out here. Well, when Gary Healy purchased that property, that fell off the contract because it's not now with them and them. So he bought it, was paying it off. And actually, it was me. I went to Gary and I said, what do you think about us doing events out here? And he's like, no, I can't do that because I don't own the property. So then once he got the property purchased, I went back to him. It was during COVID. And there was a group called Bud's Bros and Brews. And I really liked what they were doing with the community. They were going around and leaving gift bags on doorsteps to people in the group. It might be a couple of joints and some papers and a beer and a lighter, you know, just whatever. But it was just random people that were picking out of their group and doing that. And they were talking about a Bud's Bros and Brews event. And I thought, well, guys, if I could offer you Rainbow Farms to do it at, what a better place to do it at, because I love what you guys are doing. So I went to the owner now, and I was like, look, I got these guys. What do you think about? Okay, let's try it. And that's where we started off about 3 years ago. We started Rainbow Farms back up. Basically, I'm right here with the owner. You know, we're going over everything. We're talking.
So you guys are starting up events again. And are you guys also growing? Is there hemp or weed growing on the farm now? Or
no, we can't grow. We can't grow because we're doing events.
Okay. Okay.
And we're not metric events either. We're with our caretakers. That's the events we throw. So our caretakers can come out here and sell their surplus. And we're obeying by the laws with our caretakers, but the dispensaries don't like us selling that top shelf, bro. They don't like it because there ain't no dispensary that can compete with our shit. I'm telling you.
Yeah. I was going to say, now that Michigan, now that it's cannabis is legal for the most part in Michigan, are you guys expecting any further harassment like your uncle faced at all? Or?
Well, our first event out here, I was scared to death because they said nothing could ever happen out here again. No campground, no events, no nothing. And I'm in the midst of COVID, and I've got an event planned.
Yeah.
Well, we had our event. We had a lot of people. Everything was free for everybody. Our entire first year to get the name, I wanted to get the name back out there of Rainbow Farms and let people know we're coming back.
Yeah.
So I made sure every event was free for that first year. Everything we done was free. And people started to come.
That's great.
And we've been rolling since. I mean, the owners are great people. The people love it. They come out. And thinking of my uncle up there, looking down now and seeing it being done, something he was fighting for.
Yeah.
But it's being done now on his land. And not only that, but we got Robert Rowley's son doing the sound for our stage also.
Oh, that's awesome.
And we're trying to breathe life back into the farm again. That way I can get out what really happened to people out here. Yeah. I want to get that out to people as much as possible. And that was my main main objective, starting things back up out here.
Yeah.
There, what a better way to do it than going live doing it with people actually here experiencing it.
Yeah.
Anybody comes up to Rainbow Farms and asks for Boss, I'll take them for the grand tour. And explain that history to them and show them the history.
Yeah, it's beautiful that you're continuing Tom and Raleigh's dream and really kind of bringing it back. I think that's a beautiful and poetic. Unfortunately, they're not here to see it, but it's a poetic end to the situation. Well, and it's a beginning, not an end. It's really a beginning, a new beginning for the farm and for you guys. And, you know, it's unfortunate that their story never got the kind of coverage it deserved. As we mentioned in the intro, 9/11 happened a week afterwards, and that became the only news story anyone cared about. And that's unfortunate because this story is a tragic tale of government abuse and overreach, and it needs to be heard. And I'm happy to play my small part in helping people know about it. So, any final thoughts before we go, Boss?
My thoughts is just I hope people remember what Tom and Raleigh lost their lives for at the end. It was their beliefs in marijuana. Their beliefs and their rights. And when they were taken from Tom and Raleigh, they had no other option. That's all I can say.
Yeah. Hopefully nothing like that will ever happen to any cannabis users or activists ever again.
Not.
Well, I just want to say thank you again so much, Boss, for coming on the show today and sharing your uncle's story. And giving us a lot to think about and providing your perspective, because there's a lot that you talked about that wasn't in the reports, like you said. And so it's been super valuable and really special having you on the show. I really appreciate your time today.
Thank you for being interested. I really appreciate that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Take care, man. Mm-hmm. Bye. All right, everyone. And that's going to do it for this edition of Canthropology. For more information on the World of Cannabis Museum project, or to read our Canthropology blog, please visit our website at worldofcannabis.museum. If you'd like to contact us, you can hit us up on social media or shoot us an email at canthropology@gmail.com. If you've enjoyed the show, we invite you to go ahead and click the subscribe button, leave us a review, share it with your friends, and follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. A quick shout out to our awesome media partners, Cannabis Radio, Haze Radio, and of course, Leaf Magazine, in whose pages you can find the Canthropology column every month. Thanks again for listening, everyone. I hope you enjoyed the episode, and I hope you'll join us again next time here on Canthropology. Until then, this is Bobby Black, and I am history.